Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for Autumn Semester 2022. Today, financial statement analysis. The lecture today and on Wednesday has a mathematical component to it, and I'll discuss that after we've had a chance to look at the numbers, as we always do. Bear with me one moment here while I put myself back together again for another round. Ma'am, is it a bull day or a bear day? Bull. Yeah, you got to be forceful. Bull day. Yeah, a real bull day. As a matter of fact, it is indeed a bull day, and it is a clean bull day. You notice a classic pattern. The largest companies in the world, the 30 industrials, or almost the largest perhaps, they were up a little less than 0.75%. And then the 500 big companies, more risk, they were up a little more than 1%. And then the NASDAQ, the small, higher risk companies, scrappy companies, they're up more than 1.25%. Just a typical day, strong bull market is showing up. And if you go over here and you have a look at the bonds, just to make sure things are going okay over there, well, sure enough, the bond market, bond yields up, bond prices down. That means investors are selling bonds and the safer instruments, and they are heading over here and spending the money buying stocks. That is bullish behavior. There is no question that there is an optimism in the market right now. The sentiment is that, first of all, the economy is actually in recovery right now. And inflation is still going to be showing some difficulties for a couple of months, but we're already seeing the precursor numbers that are telling us that it is going to abate, and rather rapidly, toward the end of the year. So the markets are looking up. We also have the prospect of a relatively end relatively soon to the conflict in Eastern Europe. That will open up the avenues for grain to be safe and transport out of the region. Perhaps some more hydrocarbon products will come out. So good news for now. And if we go over here, crude is just kind of bouncing around in a range between about 82 and 88 right now. It's, as I said, it came below 90. And as a result, you see gas prices have eased back a little bit. They were around 389 a gallon in this area, and they've come back down to the mid-370s. So that helps. We don't have to spend as much on gas. Now, gold and silver were having an odd day. Gold was up. I got nothing on silver. Why it popped like that? It's not a speculator's kind of metal, certainly not like gold. So there must have been some kind of supply or demand kind of thing on gold that spooked the markets, push the price of silver up. It's coming back up toward that $20 range per kilo. I think that's per kilo. Is that what that is? Or is that per pound? Per ounce. Okay, per ounce. Okay. Anyway, going over here, and as you can see, the 10-year bond yield is going up, which means price is going down. Investors are getting out of the bonds, and they're moving over here to the equities. And that's good news. Now, if we come over here all the way to the other markets, Tokyo had a good day. It was strong in the opening. Then it just kind of drifted, and then it got a little strength there at the closing. So as the sun was going down in Tokyo, it came up in London. London surged upward, and it had a good day too. And so then that good news moved right across the Atlantic here to the East Coast this morning. And so we had a good bull day here. In other words, we've got global optimism, and that's a little more than just one country's traders feeling frisky. This is an overall positive sentiment. How long it will last, I can't say. I was actually positioned early this morning. I was going to take a real hard bear position, and then I got spooked by how happy people seem to be, so I got out. Unfortunately, I saved myself a lot of money because I would have gotten creamed today in this market. But there you are. Good news overall. However, there is something that I might want to look at trading on the Standard & Poor's 500, those 500 companies. I said, let's look at that. Here's what's odd to me, though. Overall, over the past 52 weeks, on the average day, S&P has traded, those 500 stocks, have traded about 3.5 billion shares. That's awfully thin trading there at 2.1 billion. Indicates that there's still a lot of money on the sidelines. Now, that could be institutional investors who aren't going to just jump in as soon as things look a little happy and sunny and there's rainbows outside. But they're still holding back on their big money and their big investment types of plays. And so there is room for, obviously, for upside, strong upside, because there's money on the sidelines looking for that final reason to start to get involved. On the other hand, those investors that are the heavies like that, they might be a little suspicious of this. There is an old term, we call it a sucker's rally. And back in the day, we would actually create sucker's rallies. We'd start bringing stock prices up because all these idiots would just jump right in and then we'd sell the floor out from under them. And they'd go home poor. And I'm not saying this is a sucker's rally, but still, that's a little concerning to me, that thin volume there. And it's across the board on the Dow. Well, actually, look at that. The Dow had a strong day, so there's money going into those big, huge companies. NASDAQ, yeah. See, the NASDAQ is thin trading too. So apparently the optimism, the big money is moving toward the biggest stocks, but they're still holding back on things that aren't ginormous. And I'm again doing this because this is how you begin to think about these markets, how you begin to start to trade. And when people ask you what you are thinking, you don't just say, I think, I feel. You have judgment and you have knowledge that has been taught you by a former trader in an academic environment. So anyway, there is that. Now, I'm going to take you down to the level of a stock. And we'll just look at one, and then I'll use that as a platform. Target. Target, as it were. Okay, as you can see, it moves with the market, relatively safe security, and it is up just like the market is up. Now the bid-ask spread, good grief, that is a monster bid-ask spread. You'd buy a share at $173.98, you could sell it for $173, so you're already in the hole quite a bit right off the bat. That's kind of depressing as hell. Volume was weak, as we saw overall, volume was weak. So, I mean, essentially it's a good market, but I'm a little bit concerned about the weakness in some of the securities in that market. The enthusiasm of the big players isn't there. And maybe it will come, but we don't know. Always when you hear a bull talking to you, just wait to see if there's a bear waiting in the background to eat his lunch. Moving on here to today's topic. I'm going to take you over to SEC.gov. I'm going to pull up some financial statements. Now, in your resources tab in VeggieNet, you have a financial ratios worksheet, formula sheet. Now, you can bring that to the midterm and to the final exam. Don't write on this because I allow you your own note card for the midterm of the final. But this is there for a reference. Here's the deal. I don't care how well you memorize these formulas. You are not accountants. In fact, I really hope that you can calculate things right, do better than I do with arithmetic, but that's not the purpose I have either. I want you to know what these numbers are saying, how you interpret the numbers. We have machines that can do calculation faster than any human on earth. We have people called accountants who do this kind of stuff for a living. You can go to websites and get these ratios, but that's not where you get the knowledge of what they're telling you. Accountants create information products. They create them for a variety of information consumer constituencies, for the management, for the board of directors, for the shareholders, for outside groups, unions, activist organizations, the SEC, the states. They create these financial products for different consumers. We have used them, and almost always we're twisting them, adding things, subtracting things, dividing and multiplying things. We use them as sort of a raw resource, along with other raw resources, for our purposes. And in ratio analysis, we're using accounting statements. And so what I'm going to do, I am going to bring up financial statements of Target, TGT. And I will use these formulas to get all of them. But along the way, we're saying, what does this mean? First of all, what does a ratio mean in general? And what does this number that we just got mean for us in our world? And it's interesting, too, because literally there are 100 or more than 100 ratios. This is kind of like a golden selection that we all kind of like. There's one in here, in fact, that's not even in your book. It had fallen out of favor many years ago, even though I kept teaching it, and now it's suddenly gotten back into favor again. So there's that. And but always the emphasis when we do this in a class like finance, we aren't really interested in you nailing every formula. I'm not going to, for example, I promise you that I will not sneak into your dorm room some night and say, calculate the current ratio for Tesla. I won't do that, partly because you might have a firearm and shoot my ass, but partly also because simply it's not my concern. The formulas are right there, and I mean, you'll see them, and when you use them enough, and some of you will use them in your professional careers, you'll remember them, and you might even be able to get a quick eyeball of the actual underlying numbers and say, that inventory turnover looks to be about. If it's absolutely necessary to your professional development, absolutely, you will remember them and you'll memorize them as time goes on. For our purposes, I want you to know how to read them and interpret them. And so that's where this kind of a lecture is. And the one on Wednesday, we're aiming in that direction. And on the exam, on the midterm and the final, you'll see that I will not ask you to calculate a ratio. I will not. I will sure as heck ask you to interpret a ratio for me. And I'll find several different ways to do that. What's a good number? What's a bad number? Now, one thing I want to point out, with these ratios, there really isn't a good number and a bad number. There are a couple of things you have to think about. Okay, what is the industry average for this ratio? Like, for example, return on assets. Oh, okay, we get the ROA as 12.5%. Well, what's the average in this industry? That would give us more information than just the raw number. The other, and then there's a second question on that too. Why is it that number? In some cases, companies can manipulate these numbers intentionally or unintentionally and give a very wrong picture of the company's future. And I will even mention a famous story about this from maybe the turn of the century. But all that's in what we're doing here. There's also another thing, too. Many of these numbers, if they're too high, that's bad. If they're too low, that's bad. There is a middle ground that you have to consider for many of these numbers. So, for example, times interest earned down here. That if that number is below one, that's the end of your company. You are in bankruptcy, right? You are in default. That's it. However, if that number is too high, that's a bad sign. I did Tesla in the class right before this. They had a times interest earned that was over 17, a factor of 17 times. That's not a good sign at all. That tells me that Tesla has a very weak ability to understand gains to leverage. We'll get all that here. Now, SEC.gov, company filing search. And by the way, I will upload this on Wednesday evening after I've finished working with this in the Wednesday lecture. I will upload this spreadsheet. One thing I'm going to do with the Excel, I show you doing this in Excel, but in the background, I'm also showing you best practices in Excel. What's more like what you would want to do for your own purposes as you develop as a professional. So for Edgar, we're going to go into filings, we're going to type TGT, and we're going to get target. We're going to look for its latest 10K, which was in March, because that'll have full year numbers in it. And I'm going to go over here, once I click on that, I'm going to go to interactive data, that blue button, and I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to bring down the Excel financials. As I've said before, the SEC requires that every public company, and we're talking about millions, all provide every financial statement in a monster Excel document. A quick word here. First of all, this is original source data. So if you're doing a term paper or research paper for any class, this is where all of your other financial statements for a company would originate. They would all use these. So if you get numbers, you use this and cite Edgar Filing at SEC.gov, that is authentic. That is indisputably right. Now, a technical issue. Sometimes when you download an Excel, some people, when they download these, they get an error message. They can't enable editing. The way you get around that is over here in your file options, there is one of the sites will say trust certificate. Yeah, trust center. You tell it that SEC.gov should go on your white list. And that way, you see, the problem is that Excel has a history of being used to transmit viruses. The payload is in the VBS. Visual Basic Scripts are how you write macros. The problem is Visual Basic Scripts are also very easy to use to write viruses. As a matter of fact, VBS, Visual Basic Scripts, has the unfortunate nickname of Virus Builder Scripts. So that's why your computer might have a security setting high enough that it just doesn't trust anything that's got a VBS in it. So that you just say, trust the SEC. I guarantee you that if a company transmitted a virus to the SEC, that would not be a very wise thing. Now, a couple of starters here. Don't just take these Excel spreadsheets with all these hundreds of, look at all these stupid worksheets that they've got in this. That's normal for these. Just start scooting things around so that the ones that you want to work with are together. So I see, that's the balance sheet. Consolidated statements of financial position, that's a balance sheet. Put it over here with your statement of operations, because I'm going to use those two. And then sometimes I'll have a third one that I might want to use too. Statements of cash flow. There we go. So I'm going to grab that one. I'm going to scoot that over to be with the income statement and balance sheet. Just move them around. Manipulate this all you want. See, that's the whole thing about a work environment. You rearrange things so that they are in the way that is most productive to you. Famous story about that back in World War II. They had these places where these planes were being assembled, and they had this new manager of one of the airplane factories looked down on the production floor, and he just had a fit at the mess. Look at all these tools. They left them here, all these tools at the end of the day. So he made this rule that all tools must be put back in their cubby holes on the shelves at the end of every day. Well, productivity went down about 80% because those guys knew right where their tools should be so they can reach them and get to work right away. So you manipulate your work environment so that it works for you, not for some type A personality who wants everything in a cubbyhole. Leave these alone. They were put that way for a reason. Yeah, it wasn't my reason, so bite me. Okay, so now, the thing we're going to do here is between the income statement and the balance sheet, I'm going to insert a new worksheet. I'm going to call it the ratios sheet. This goes back many years in the second wave of web development around the 21st century, when the 21st century began. There was an effort to create a sort of standardized way that things would be done. And this actually came from the gaming world of 10 years earlier, 10 to 12 years earlier, called the SCP, Secure, Contain, Protect. You secure your data, you contain it so that it's in the way that you want it, and then you make a place where the calculations are given results, and you protect the rest of the document. Once you've got the ratios done, you protect, password protect, everything else, because I guarantee you that you're going to produce this for information consumers. You don't want them looking behind the curtain. You've got the numbers right here. You don't want some idiot playing around with your data. You don't want some fool thinking that he can question your formulas. That would be for your peers and your supervisors. But the end users of your document, all they need to see is your work product. So secure, get the data, contain it, put it in the order that you want it, and then protect it when you're finished so that no one can prowl around and see what's what and question you. I can give you some famous, and I will on Wednesday, famous examples where they didn't follow this old protocol of Excel, which isn't even taught that much anymore. But welcome to the world of the old geezers like me. Anyway, now, we're going to just go through and, really, where am I? Oh, financial analysis formula. I don't need these anymore. Okay, so the financial analysis formulas. And what am I thinking here? That's all I need. I'm trying to think of anything else. I don't think I'll need a calculator. I might for something. I just put it up there. Okay, so here we go. Now, a few of these you won't be able to calculate really quickly. Like, see this one, average collection period. Companies used to report on their income statement sales and credit sales so that I could get to easily pick off the average daily credit sales by dividing the credit sales by 365. They don't put it there anymore, and that's a problem. So we won't collect that. You'd have to go, actually, I think you'd see it in the statement of cash flows, the accounts, the credit sales, but you'd also find it in the notes to the financial. It's not immediately available, and so I'm not going to worry about that one. I think they give you a homework problem in the chapter, but they tell you the average daily credit sales or something like that. Now, there's another one down here. Where am I? Oh. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these today. Some of them are just arcane. There's one here in the liquidity that long ago was just a standard. And then it vanished. And just recently, it has shown back up again. And it's not in most books. Your textbook doesn't show the burn ratio. But I'll tell you a story that really convinces you that it's worth knowing this one. And interestingly enough, a class I teach earlier in the day, short-term financial management, oh God, the burn ratio is literally canon in the ratios that the short-term financial managers in a company calculate. As a matter of fact, there's a couple of burn. The daily burn rate, the burn ratio, it's quite popular. So I'll show you that one. It's easy to calculate. And if you think about it, it makes sense to calculate it. But on we prod with the profitability ratios. I'm going to start with the liquidity ratios. Just to do this right. Now, I'm going to do 2021 and then back it up to 2020. Wait a minute. Let me look at Target. Are they doing 2022. Oh, okay. My bad. 2022 and 2021. Okay. Now I'll go down here and you just create the categories as you go along. Liquidity. And I'm going to talk about each one as we go through it. Now, liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Now, if you go on the web, you will find incorrect definitions. And I guarantee you that on the first exam, on the midterm and the final, I will try to have you show me that that's what you relied on instead of the lecture. The one that you see the most commonly is that liquidity is the ease, which is a very fluffy term anyway, with which an asset can be turned into cash. That's absolutely wrong, because then we couldn't talk about the liquidity of cash that way. You see, you need that technically precise definition, which is one of the great perils of using those quick and easy knowledge sites, is they don't know what they're talking about. They don't think about what the implications of their quick and easy stuff is. So liquidity, let me give you an example here. Okay. See this? $20. This is highly liquid. Why? Because I can go to you, sir. You are working at McDonald's. And I would say I would like a McCheeseburger, a quarter McPounder, McPlease. And you say, why McYes? Would you like McFries with that? And I say, McAbsolutely. And so I pull up and you say, that'll be $20. And I say, McWhat? Are you McOut of your McMind? Okay, fine, I'm hungry. I converted this into a cheeseburger in seconds. That's liquidity, high liquidity. But the trade-off is twofold. One, this has hardly any value. You say, yes, it has, that's what I'm doing. Are you going to eat this? You can't eat it. Well, I suppose you could smoke it if you're really into weird shit. But it has no intrinsic value, or virtually none. The other thing is that it is going to make you nothing. This money in my pocket, if I had this in a long-term investment, I'd make money off it. I could. As this, it's useless. As far as any investment return, it is nothing. Now take you, madam. We're in the Paleolithic period. You are a moose hunter. You hunt moose. You have killed a moose. And you're dragging it around. Anyone want to trade me something for a moose? I look out, no. Other people look out, After a few days, you finally find someone. It turns out it was me. I make pies. And so I'll say, well, okay, fine. I'll trade you moose for pies, okay? It wasn't efficient. It wasn't immediate. But that moose had intrinsic value. You could trade it, but you could also eat the moose. Moose burger, moose steak, moose flambé. Moose over noodles. Moose salad. Oh, anyway, okay, you see the point. It had intrinsic value. You see, the less liquid something is, the more likely it is to have a value of itself. And the other thing is that the moose, even though you can't trade it very quickly, when you finally traded it, you traded it for my absolutely delicious apple pies. Yes. It was a good investment over the long run. Now, let's take the other side of it. Liquidity. Okay. I'm going to return to you, sir. You are highly, highly illiquid. I mean, if I had to turn you into cash right now, what am I going to get? $5 for your spleen and maybe $2 for your liver, and you're not liquid. Even if I make you liquid in a giant blender, you're still not very tasty. I'm sorry. So you see, you have low liquidity, extremely low liquidity. And yet, the present value of your future expected cash flows is somewhere between $4 and $10 million if you're the average person. High long-term value. As you invest more in yourself, as others invest in you, you develop this extraordinary value over your life. So, less liquidity, higher overall value. I come back to you at the McDonald's. I'm dragging my house behind me. I should like to trade my McHouse for a McQuarter Pounder. And you say, are you McOut of your McMind? No. The house is worth a fortune, but I can't trade it immediately. Exchange one asset for another. It doesn't have that quality. Now, eventually I can sell it, put it on market, wait around, die of starvation while it sits on market. Now, you see the point, though. That's this idea of liquidity. Liquidity is important, though, to a company. You have to pay your bills. So if you don't pay your bills, then you are in bankruptcy, and that's the end of the story. So the first one we look at is the current ratio. The current ratio is nothing but your current assets, total current assets, divided by your total current liabilities. That's nearly one. In other words, they can just about cover their short-term liabilities with their short-term assets. Now, is that a good number? That is entirely dependent upon the company's cash management policy. And this is weird because I'm doing this lecture in a more intensive way in my course this morning. Some companies want this current ratio to be well above one. Well, others want it to be well below one. The old standard is one is like a fulcrum for it. Okay, I'll buy that. But do know that companies can deviate quite a bit from that and be perfectly fine. Now, the next one is the upright term for it is the quick ratio. The down and dirty term is, it's called the acid test. You'll hear me say acid. That's what it, we call it, the acid test. It's like this. If I look at that state, that balance sheet, see those short-term assets? Inventory is really not. That, see that $13 billion? That inventory isn't worth $13 billion. If I needed to liquidate that tomorrow to pay my current bills, I'm going to get pennies on the dollar for it. So realistically, inventory, that's not really a liquid asset in a realistic kind of way. So what I do is I say equals, and then I open parentheses, and I go over here to the balance sheet, and I say, take the total current assets and subtract off that inventory. And then I divide the result by the current liabilities, total current liabilities. Whoa, that is a real drop in the liquidity. So in other words, a lot of what appeared to be target's liquidity was in stuff that really isn't that liquid. And then finally is this age-old ratio called the burn. Now, let me give you a context for this. I'm going to take you, madam. Yeah, you. You're the facilities manager at Mega Factory Incorporated. Okay? And the day has finally come. The zombie apocalypse. My God, we barricade the windows and the doors. Throw them all of our current assets. Zombie, don't want that. Okay? So don't throw them the inventory. They didn't want that. So you throw them everything else. They don't want. You know what they want? Brains. The cash. That's all that matters to the zombies. The zombies are your current liabilities. And the only thing that's going to make a zombie happy is brains. Your cash. I don't know what the heck that all meant, but... And don't forget double tap and cardio and all that. A few of you caught that reference, but here we go. So all we do for the burn ratio is say that equals, and you take your cash divided by your current liabilities. The zombies want nothing else to satisfy their current liability hunger, so you throw them your cash brains. And, oh, they're not going to be happy. They got only about 27% of the brains they wanted. Okay? Now, let me tell you a story about this one. Why it has kind of come back. It was last year, I think it was last year, the year before that, there got to be this sort of fad on this Reddit thread about a company called GameStop. GameStop was a dead dog. It was obvious to the high-powered financial analysts. It was gone. GameStop is shrink-wrapped games, and no one uses shrink-wrapped games anymore. You live stream or you download. The only other thing GameStop does is it sells some consoles, but it's dead. It's dead. Well, there was this one younger analyst who wrote a very interesting piece. She said, "Are you out of your minds? GameStop has $6 billion in cash." And she didn't use the term burn ratio, but she said, take their cash divided by their this monster amount of cash, divided by their little tiny current liabilities. This company can't die. This company could use that $6 billion and survive just eating it for years. Or they can take that $6 billion and turn it into all kinds of awesome new things. She said, this is not a sell company. This is not a short company. This is a company that is a frickin' buy. And well, spank me, she was right. And so ever since then, suddenly this burn ratio has been rehabilitated thanks to that one younger analyst using both her thinking about what matters and also using old time ways of analyzing. And boy, that's the kind of thing that I just love to hear. And I mean, the old time analysts, they got their shorts eaten in that. Literally, they were short positions on GameStop and they got creamed. GameStop is at some insane value now. It used to be a couple of dollars a share. I mean, it's just wonderful to see that. But the burn ratio, just look, do they have cash? If they have cash and they can come close to covering their current liabilities, they can make it, okay? And that's the one, so anymore, we are always watching out. Another one example, Steak and Shake. Steak and Shake last year, it's been in trouble. It's been in some serious trouble. And last year, the big worry we all had was we were looking at burn because they had a current portion of a long-term debt due. And the burn just on that one cash divided by that one short-term liability was way below one. And it was just like, good God, they won't make it. Somehow, they found some place where they pulled the cash out and they paid that current bill, and so they're still in business. But I mean, it still does not bode well because that burn ratio is just so low. It's almost like it's a death watch. Unless they can figure out some way to start generating cash flow, that means sell burgers. That's what it comes down to. Getting themselves back into the hip and with it crowd with their menu, they're gone. Burn matters. Anyway, okay, now we've done these liquidity ratios. And as I said, there is a place where it gets scary. It's too low. But there's also a place where it gets scary if it's too high. It's like I said, the example of Netflix is a great example. Netflix borrowed this wad, $1.2 billion or something like that, in long-term or in intermediate-term notes. And they put it all into cash, for God's sake. Something that will produce nothing. It doesn't earn any interest. It's just sitting there, spinning around, not being used to invest in long-term, high-interest, high-return-on-investment assets. It just sat there. And, I mean, the question is, why are they doing that? That's ridiculous. Their current ratio is insane. But their short-term financial assets management policy is that we need high liquidity to take on rapid new investments. In other words, back in the old days, from the time an idea was put down on paper through to writing the screenplay, getting the talent, getting the funding, getting everything put together, getting the sets, getting all the grips, lights, audio, Cinemasters, getting all that together, you could be 2 years, 3 years to the pilot. And that can't work these days. You have got to get those shows in, as we used to say, in the can within weeks, within a couple of weeks, desirably. From script to first run, a first show on the TV set. Why do you need it that fast? Because people are desperate for new content. Also, if there's an idea and you've got it, guarantee you 50 other idiots have got the same idea and they're going to try to produce the same show. oh, we got a great show. It'll be with fairies and monsters and gods and demons. And yeah, that'll be new. Yeah, everyone's thinking of it. So you got to get yours out there fast, and you've got to have some shtick, talent in it. Something like, well, everyone's got the nudity now. So weird death scenes, I don't know. But you got to get it out there fast. And so that's what Netflix is saying to the people who are saying your liquidity is way too high. Netflix is saying, bite me. This is what we have to do. We have to have this cash so we can throw it as fast as possible into a new show. Amazon Prime is doing the same thing. Hulu is doing the same thing. Their cash, you look at all of them, their liquidity ratios are an embarrassment. They're so high. But that's what they have to do. So don't be too judgmental too fast until you see what the industry is doing and see what the logic of the company is. Right now, Netflix, they have $6 billion in cash and cash equivalents. $6 billion. That's down from $8 billion they had last year. But I mean, you see that it's deliberate. They mean to be doing this. Okay, I've bitched enough about that one. Now let's go to profitability. One thing to mention very quickly here is that a lot of companies don't put in to their income statement an important line. It's right here. It's their gross, it's their gross profit or gross income. So you have to put in gross income because you need it. It's actually important. It's one that's important. And back in the day, every financial statement had exactly the same lines with exactly the same names all the way down. Anymore, I mean, I would have thought the gross income would be something the SEC would have a cow if you didn't have. But they don't care. I mean, most companies don't have it. So all you do is you just take your your revenues minus your cost of goods sold. See that $31 billion? That is how much of what came into the cash drawer survived wholesale. That's what it means. That's what it is. So in this case, Target had $106 billion. Is that billions? Good God. And they spent $75 billion for the products that they sold. So what survived the wholesale was $31.042 billion. That's what that is, pure and simple. So the gross margin, all it does is take your gross, well, let's try it over here, your gross income divided by your revenues. So what that tells us is how many cents of, in a very real way, this tells us how many cents of every dollar that went into the cash drawer survived wholesale costs. In Target's case, about 30 cents. That can be all over the board. Companies that are in heavy services, they have high gross margins because they don't have much cost of goods sold. Some companies don't even report a cost of goods sold. There are other companies that, I mean, they actually have gross margins that are like 10 cents. They are low margin. They're low markup companies. Walmart is, to a large extent, a low markup company. You'd see their gross margin as being not very high at all. But they sell hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars worth of stuff, so that makes up for it. Now the next one is operating income. Operating margin, I should say. Operating margin. That all you do is you take your operating income, sometimes they call that EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, and operating income, EBIT, divided by your revenues. This tells us how much of every dollar that went into the cash registers survived wholesale and all of your selling, general, and administrative expenses. So in other words, after they paid their wholesale prices for their goods, they paid their light bills, they paid their salaries and wages, they paid their internet fees, they paid all of their marketing costs, all that, 8.5 cents are still there. It's getting a little scary down here. And that's kind of typical. You bleed out fast, especially in that in your operating expenses. That can be yeehaw territory. Now you get your net margin. How much survived everything the company paid? That's equal to the operations. You take your net earnings, they call it net earnings, divided by your revenue. This is how many cents of every dollar belongs to the shareholders. For every dollar that the company took in, it paid its prior claims, and what's left for the shareholders for dividends or for plow back into the company is about 6.5 cents. Now, is that a good number or a bad number? Believe it or not, it depends. In some companies, and these, by the way, are percentages. These three are percentages. And the next two are percentages, too. Format the cells. Percentage. Now, you will see some companies that have a net margin that's like 30, 40%. Just pisses me off when I see that. Then you'll see some companies that have net margins of a penny or under. In other words, for every dollar that the company brought in, 1 cent survives to the shareholders. And they're doing great. Giant industrial companies tend to be that way because it's a massive operation, so there are massive, massive costs. But because their revenues are in the hundreds of billions of dollars, possibly the trillions of dollars, a lot of money still is there for the shareholders at the bottom line. The major international oil and gas companies, they traditionally had 1 to 2 cent net margins, but they sold so much of their product that they were still some of the greatest investments you could want. In a company like mine, I will have a net margin that is around 32%. But quite honestly, my company sucks. I mean, if I didn't have those electroshock paddles, my company would be flatlining every night. So don't think too much about these numbers. You look at your industry average. You also look at the change in that number from year to year to see if it's improving or eroding. So now we have two other ones. Return on assets. Think about the company like a ginormous portfolio. A portfolio earns some amount of money. So what if we were to say, let's take the net earnings divided by the entire company as a portfolio, divided by total assets. Well, that's not bad, actually. 12.91%, that's decent. Okay. So now, the other one is return on equity, ROE. Now this one, if we consider just what the shareholders have put into this company, their investment, by buying the stock when the stock came out in IPO, and by foregoing dividends by having net income plowed back into retained earnings, we could say, let's take the net income and divide it by the shareholders' equity in the corporation. Now, this number will always be at least as large Geez, did I do that right? Let me do that again. Equals net income, net earnings, divided by total shareholders' investment or equity. Holy cow! See, that's not normal. That is really high. Good grief. 54.15%. Okay. Well, I'm impressed. I should go over to Target tonight and buy myself something. Okay. Return on equity. Okay, fine. Now, I caution, and I'll talk about this on Wednesday. ROA is especially vulnerable to a bad interpretation. There are companies that can have their ROA skyrocketing. So ROE goes up, and yet those companies are on the verge, and in many cases back at the turn of the century, they were causing absolute catastrophes that cost hundreds and hundreds of human lives. And it was all showing up in the return on assets, which was going up. And all these investment analysts said, oh, this is awesome. They didn't see why the return on assets was going up. And it was that why that was the warning sign that there were going to be disasters that would kill many, many people, that would cause pollution that in some cases has not been completely remediated to this day. It was all because analysts didn't understand that not always is a good ratio becoming better a good sign. But I'll tell you that story. And I was in that business at the time down in Texas. And it was just amazing that, anyway. Okay, so now I'm going to go over here to the asset activity ratios. Now, I'll point this out again. I said this. This formula right here, account the average collection period, I can't do that one without the credit sales. You tell me how many credit sales they have for the year, and I could divide that by 365, and I'd have it. But it is no longer normally reported. Let me show you here. It used to be very typical to have total revenue broken down into cash sales and credit sales. And then there was a minus line for bad debt allowance. They don't do any of that anymore. So I can't see how much of this $106 billion was credit sales. I'd have to go into the notes of the financial statement, I think, to find it. So, like I said, in the book Cengage Problems, they give you the accounts receivable, so you just divide it by 365 and you got it. But for us, we can't do it. So the next one we'll do is inventory turnover. Now, if you look at the financials, it's sales over inventory. This is an important one. Equals, we get our statement of operations, sales divided by inventory. This number, 7.625, says that Target completely cleared its warehouses 7.625 times last year. In other words, it completely cleared out and replaced inventory 7.625 times. Now, in general, the higher that number, the better, because you're getting rid of inventory as fast. There are some companies in Japan, it's well known, they have a just-in-time system, which means that their inventory turnover is nearly infinity. They don't keep any inventory for the car manufacturers. They need a car door, they tell the company that makes that car door to bring one. You need light bulbs for the car, the company that makes the light bulbs brings them. So in other words, inventory is virtually zero, so you're dividing by zero. That's an amazing system that can do that. We tried it here in the United States. When our auto manufacturers realized that the Japanese were eating our lunch, they started trying to do what the Japanese do. And that led to some of the worst catastrophes you can imagine. The auto industry fell apart, and whole cities like Detroit and parts of other cities fell into the crater that was created by these companies, these car manufacturers that had tried to do just in time. It was a freaking disaster. Why? Because we don't build our factories the way they do. We don't want to in the end. Now here's the other downside. The faster the inventory turnover, that's great. You don't have to have as much inventory space. Your opportunity cost of holding inventory is down. The whole nine yards, wonderful. Okay, get that inventory out. Get it out. Now bring more in. Get that inventory out. Sell it. What happens if you have a bottleneck? That was COVID-19 lockdown. They wiped out their inventory. We want more. Sorry, Charlie. Lockdown. You're dead. These companies, they cleared their warehouses, cranking the way they'd always had. And then they found out that there wasn't anything back the supply chain. And the suppliers had rotated their inventory. They ordered. There was nothing there. They ordered and there was nothing there. All the way back the line. It took months to, and we're still not completely there. There's still a few empty shelves. That was why the empty shelves were there, because of the obsession with high inventory turnover. We don't want to hold in. Well, if you had, you would have had some more toilet paper to put on the shelves, wouldn't you, Cupcake? But no, you had to get it out. And then there we were. The same thing happened in several other pipelines recently. There had been a movement, I don't know, I might have already said this, to close down a lot of the oil refineries. We don't need as much oil anymore. We don't want to keep hydrocarbon products, the gasoline and the distillates. We don't want to keep as large inventories because we're all going green. Yes, we are. Well, gee, then when the whole planet that isn't green, including much of the United States, didn't get any more oil from many countries like Russia, going through Ukraine and pissing off Kazakhstan, and then the dodgy little situations we had with our friends in China and India and Turkey buying some of the oil that was left. Well, we had depleted our inventories, and it's just now that they're coming back online. It took that long. It's not that easy to get oil out of the ground, into the reserve tanks, onto the very large dirty tankers, get it to the ports that can handle it, getting it into the pipes, getting it to the refiners, getting it from the refiners to the gas stations. And once that supply chain had been broken down, filling it back up was a nightmare because there wasn't any inventory in the system. So that's my bitch about inventory turnover. Great idea. Lower your opportunity cost of holding inventory, but at the same time, you might want to think about those what-if scenarios. Asset turnover. This takes the same concept, but it says, what if our entire company is just a giant inventory? How many times a year do we turn that over? So we take our net income, and in this case, sales, divided by total assets. That's actually a fairly high ratio. I mean, you know, like I said, these ratios, depending on the industry, they can be all over the place. But they turned their company, the whole company, over almost twice, almost every 6 months, that company is turning over. If you measure turnover by sales, that's actually, I do know retail, but I'm not going to go out too far on a limb here. But I would say that that's darn good. I mean, the numbers right now, I'm looking at Target, it is darn strong. I mean, this is how we do this. We look at the numbers and then we interpret them. We don't just say, well, that's a 1.96, that looks fine to me. No, we want to think about it. Okay, now the next one I'll do is debt. Now the one is times interest earned. This is one of those ratios that's a double-edged sword. If this ratio says, take the money that we have, the company has, to pay its interest payments. That would be operating income, earnings before interest and taxes. So Target had $8.9 billion. And its interest expense was a lousy $421 million. So Target can pay its interest payment a whopping 21 plus times over. Understand that if that number goes below one, that means the company has died. Because if you don't pay your interest expense, the debt holders turn you off. So this is way above that. The real question is, the farther up the better? No. A company that has a times interest earned that's too high is not taking advantage of the gains to leverage. And we're going to see that in the next one, which is debt to total assets. Now, I caution you. The way we usually do this one is we take the debt on the balance sheet, but the only debt we take is the long-term debt. Long-term debt and other borrowings. That's the only one that we take for this. You're saying, well, that number right above it, fat boy, that's a big number. Yes, but that's what they've already committed to pay. That's what they're writing checks for right now. So the only one that really is significant is that long-term debt. And then you divide that by their total assets. This company is about 25% debt. We would say that the capital structure of Target is 25% debt, 75% equity. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises capital structure. Now, the higher the debt component is, the riskier the company. they got more they have to pay. You have to pay your debt holders. But the more debt you have, the more you realize gains to leverage. In about a week, 2 weeks, I'm going to show each of you in here how you can become a millionaire within about 5 years. I'm not even joking. It has to do with your willingness to take the risk of using debt instead of equity. See, if I reduce my amount of equity, then my debt magnifies my return. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.